On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Shu Bartholomew. Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Shu Bartholomew, and joining us on the Commons today, we have someone who... It's been a long time since Dr. Karen Huffer has joined us. Dr. Huffer is an author. She's an associate professor. She's a speaker, a researcher, a consultant who has devoted her career to advancing equal access for persons with disabilities to public and private services. Karen, thank you so very much for joining us today. I am very excited about having you on the show.
Thank you, Sue, and I'm really happy to be back.
It's been a long time, but we'll make sure it doesn't happen again. Tell us, what have you been up to? I know you've got a couple of books. You've got a website, so let's talk about the books in your website, and then we'll talk about what you're doing.
Okay, for anybody listening that has a question we don't answer, if they go to my website, probably the answer is there, and that's www.equalaccessadvocates.com. That's all one word, equalaccessadvocates, plural, .com.
I will make sure that it's on my website as well. We will link to that.
Good. And what I've been up to, I've been writing another book because in 2008, the Congress and Senator Harkin and others gave us a real gift in the Amendments Act to the Americans with Disabilities Act. In 1990, the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed, and largely that focused on physical disabilities, getting a ramp for a wheelchair, widening bathroom stalls, a lot of expensive construction. And all that while, what got neglected were the invisible disabilities. Those kinds of things that people go through in a lifetime, particularly in our population now that is an aging population, we have people with depression and anxiety. We have many people with post-traumatic stress disorder, some that are coming back from military deployment, but some that are being treated so badly by their neighbors, by people who have power over them, unrelenting oppression in this country, that they also are suffering PTSD. And what happened in 2008 is that law overturned four Supreme Court decisions that had neutralized the original act, and it threw open the door for all of those invisible disabilities to be accommodated in court in ways that would provide more equal access. So, and I then was write the book Unlocking Justice, which has to do with that.
Okay, so you're not talking about people who have, you know, lost a limb or for some reason have some kind of physical disability. You're talking about people who are emotionally harmed by what's been going on in their lives.
Exactly, exactly. And what happens if you are treated meanly, and I've got the research to show it, if there is human-on-human intentional trauma, it is more intense and it's harder to treat than if it's accidental. If you have an earthquake happen and you have PTSD and you lose your home and you lose a lot of things, you come out of that with societal support. It was nobody's fault. It was one of those things, and sometimes you have insurance or help from the government to rebuild. If you are falsely accused and drawn into a court of law, it's really easy to get into that court. It's really hard to get out. And once you end up in any kind of adversarial situation, with someone with power who can use systems against you, you then can easily suffer from traumatic stress, depression, anxiety, what I call obsessive-compulsive hypervigilance, where you cannot rest, you cannot recuperate, you cannot get back on your feet. And if they keep it on, and it goes on and it's protracted, it just becomes worse. And then that exacerbates any physical condition.
You know, what you're telling me is stuff that I've seen and I've heard, because I'm sure you can understand that I do get a lot of calls from a lot of people who are having problems. Karen, they're in pain. They're absolutely in pain.
Oh, yeah.
They're angry. They're crying. You know, they really are in pain, and they cannot function.
It interferes with executive functionality. And what's been used in this country now as a weapon is stress, oppression and stress and an economic attack. So if you go to court against somebody, the first thing they try and do is cost you a lot of money, so you have to give up in a war of attrition, create you as much stress as they can, so then your health will fail, again, a war of attrition. That isn't what our justice system is about. And we shouldn't be allowing it to be used as a weapon or as a tool of taking.
Is there a remedy to all of this?
Well, short of me being able to make everybody be decent and nice to one another.
Can you do that? Do you have a magic wand?
Revival of a moral code. Yes, there are things that we have to do. We really don't have a choice. This is probably the most important information that anybody can deal with in their life, and that is who is really the most frightening person for you to be around? Who might harm you or your property values or your health more? Is it someone of another race? Is it someone with a sexual orientation you don't like? Is it someone of a different ethnicity, a different religion, a different social status? Or is it somebody that grabs power to use it over you to take from you? I think we're diverted to looking at, oh, my goodness, gay marriage, whatever. Oh, my goodness, abortion. Oh, my goodness, somebody's race. Somebody's, forget it. All of that is to divert you from seeing the person you have to watch out for is the one that goes for power and profit at your expense.
Wow. That's just cutting it down to the basics, isn't it?
Well, I think that's a whole new area for prejudice. I'm prejudiced against those people that will abuse their power and our systems in order to take people's things unfairly and beat up on them. And then the person gets, here's the way it goes in court. It's like if you walk into court and the judge gets off the bench and comes down and whacks you on the knee with a ball-peen hammer. So the next time you come into court, you're limping a little bit. So the other side starts saying, oh, they're limping. Oh, see, they can't handle their affairs. See, they can't have their children. They can't have their property, whatever. So then they come down and hit you in the knee again. And at what point do you say, you have to stop hitting me in the knee, and I have to have time to recover and get strong and come back into this court? That's what, when you said, what can you do? That's what my work does. It uses the federal law, federal government's protection, to give you a fair chance. And when you come in that court limping, hold the phone. We got to stop here. Why is this happening? What do we need to do to stop it? Sometimes I have to remove a person from the courtroom so they're not having to face an adversary who has power over them and oppresses them and is lying about them. Sometimes they can't function in that environment.
Do you know how many times industry CAI HOA attorneys have sat there and mocked, ridiculed, lied about the homeowners in a court of law. Of course, these guys are in court all the time. The judges know them. Everybody in court knows them. Homeowner goes in once.
I know.
And, I mean, even people who are highly educated, people who know the law, people who...
Some are lawyers.
Some of them are lawyers, and they're being victimized.
That's right. That's right. And
by these abusive monstrosities.
Yes. Now, that's against federal law. If we file with the court, and we don't file a motion that says this person has a disability, therefore, we don't do that because this doesn't belong in the adversarial arena. In other words, you don't serve the other side with the documentation that says you need accommodations in the court. That throws it into the adversarial arena where it does not belong. So it's administrative. You file with court administration, the ADA access coordinator. That is confidential. That person then approves or denies what special accommodations are needed. Then it goes to the judge who has some flexibility to substitute or that kind of thing, but never is your medical or private information about your depression or your anxiety or PTSD to be part of the war.
Karen, let me give you an example. Homeowner A does something that the board doesn't like, and it escalates and it ends up in court. Now, homeowner A has got the funds, is perhaps even an attorney, and knows what their rights are and knows what the arguments are, and they've hired an attorney to represent them. And they go to court, and the attorney representing the association starts in with their abusive shenanigans, and they pick on things that have absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with the issues at hand. And they start with their ad hominem allegations against the homeowner. And this causes stress. I've seen where homeowners have had cardiac incidents in court because of the stress suffered. Why is it that the judge doesn't put a stop to it? Can the judge put a stop to it and say, we're going to deal with the issue of the pig and not, you know, whether or not this guy had a shower, crossed the road, or has a parking ticket?
Yes. However, it's our job to tell the judge why and how that's done.
Our job, meaning your job?
Yeah, my job or the person that's being picked on. Now, the problem is that person being picked on gets disarmed. If someone lies about you, it's almost impossible for you personally to fight that. You're trying to prove the negative. I mean, it never happened, so there's no evidence of any kind. It's just an accusation. But if it's ugly enough, if I accuse you of something horrible, immoral, if that cloud stays around you, and no matter how you try and defend yourself, it can be very hard. It is the act that makes you feel helpless. Well, now the formula for getting post-traumatic stress disorder is to feel helpless in the face of jeopardy. So what they do is they create the perfect formula to create post-traumatic stress disorder or that constellation of symptoms. It may be called something different after the next DSM comes out next year. But right now, the constellation of symptoms is usually post-traumatic stress disorder. And it can be caused in that courtroom by that behavior. Now, what do we do about that? We have developed a system that we call data analysis. And Philip Zimbardo from Stanford, who wrote the foreword to my Unlocking Justice, and who has been very helpful over the years. He wrote The Lucifer Effect. He's written many, many books. He did the Stanford Prison Experiment when he showed what happens when one person gets power over the other and how quickly it can become pathological. So by him identifying what's called fundamental attribution error, in the court, sometimes court decisions are based on those lies. And that's what we call fundamental attribution error. They attribute the situation to a lie, and then they make a mistake in what's adjudicated. So we developed a system called data analysis, and we asked for that to be an accommodation. So when you, before your case starts, or sometimes in the middle if you didn't know about it before, but before the case starts, we say that there will be times when gratuitous information will be put on the record simply for the purpose of diminishing my client's ability to function in court. And when that happens, that gratuitous information has to be recorded, and the judge has to decide, we ask the judge to decide to either take judicial notice of it, to remove it from the record, whatever we have to do. Now, what people don't understand a lot of times when they're taken into court is the only reason they're there is to make a record. And the other side that uses the court as a weapon knows this. So when they go into court, they are like used car salesmen. They're in there just plowing through and putting stuff on the record, and a lot of it are lies to diminish my client. So we have to remind the client, we are here to make a record too. So whenever they do that, we have to put something back on the record that straightens it out or something like that. But when they get non-functional, you know, I had one client that threw up every time she got too nervous. And so she would grab her mouth and run out of the courtroom. While she was gone, guess what the other side did to the record? Oh, they put all kinds of stuff on it. I'd like it put on the record that she got hysterical and ran out of the courtroom. I'd like it on the record, you know, and they went on and on. I told her, you can't leave. I said, no matter what happens when you leave, you give them control of the record. So I said, if you have to throw up, guess what? You're going to have to stay in the courtroom and throw up.
Oh, dear. That doesn't...
She wasn't too happy with her opposing counsel, so she thought, well, maybe that's not too bad. I'll just turn my head that direction.
You know, that's a plan, Karen. Yeah, it's really sad that we've come down to that.
It is terribly sad because when I was raised in Idaho, our neighbors were very important to us. We took care of each other. You know, I wrote an article not too long ago that said when you buy into one of the homeowners associations to keep the riffraff out, you better stop and look at who you're buying in the association with, because sometimes they're the neighbors from hell, and they can be.
They are. We ought to start thinking about trying to put the neighbor back in the hood, because there are no neighbors in the hood anymore.
I know.
They're just monsters.
It's a huge loss for our society. And, you know, one of the things that is historically true is that capitalistic societies fail as a culture. They're short-lived. And they're short-lived because they don't share and cooperate. Instead, they hoard, you know, taking and sitting on all this money. Think about it. That's hoarding. Hoarding is pathological. So if one part of the culture hoards, it tends to starve out other parts of the culture. And so what we're looking at is seriously a threat to the American culture by the kind of behavior that we're seeing that lacks cooperation, lacks empathy, lacks caring for one another, protecting one another. You know, we're pretty fragile on this little earth. If you study much about astronomy, oh my goodness, you know, we could all be gone tomorrow.
That's
we're
true.
Very fragile, and how we can be behaving the way we are toward one another is appalling to me. It also is impoverishing. The poorest of neighborhoods, in my opinion, are those where everybody's battling with each other and not enriching each other.
We're talking to Dr. Karen Huffer. She's an author an associate professor. She's a speaker, a researcher, a consultant who has just been giving us a ton of wonderful information right here on the Commons. And we're coming to you from Radio Fairfax in cloudy Fairfax, Virginia. Karen, we're a nation of sick people, physically sick people. Our health is not good, and we just keep adding to it. The stress is not helping, is it?
Well, I went to a psychopharmaceutical conference about a year ago, a big conference with excellent information, and the research was impeccable. And the main statement they made is that stress affects almost every organ in the body negatively. So the stress that we are put under from morning till night in this country is damaging our health. If you have a weakness, the stress is going to help you succumb. If you're strong, the stress will eat away. It eats away at inspiration. You know, I look at the people that are fighting in the courts and the compromises they're having to make. And let me make one more point. Your court building is being used by these people to steal things with no overhead. Think about that. I watched them with the people from the homeowners associations negotiating out in the hallway of the courthouse. And I think, you know, the truth of the matter is you're using this court to intimidate. You will meet on this date at this address in the courthouse, which makes the person feel like, oh, my God, this debt collection really is official. I'm going to meet in the courthouse. Well, no, it's no more official than anything else. But why are they using our public property to do their improper collections or their intimidating collections? But at any rate, to get back to the issue of stress, when you look at the people in and around that courthouse, I always have to wonder, what if this person had had ease of health care, ease of education, so they were optimized as a human being? And now they were happy out there, trusting people, and able to create. My guess is we would have cured cancer a long time ago. We would have solutions to all of the human problems, if not done in the works. We are robbing ourselves of the wealth of our very own population.
That's a sobering thought. That's a very sobering thought. But I think you're right. So, Karen, we've been doing this, and we come back, and after the fact, we try to fix things. Knee-jerk reaction, we come in, and we try to enact legislation that's going to do something to prevent some aspect of what we perceive as being an injustice. Why are we not spending time, money, effort into preventing these things from happening in the first place? Why is it that we have to wait until people are suffering, are hurting, before we decide that we're going to do something about one small, tiny aspect of it?
Well, I think that's a good question. That's a philosophical question that needs to be put before the American population. What do we prioritize? If you stop and think about it, I describe in my book how the population is divided on a continuum with people who are motivated by different things. Some people are motivated by joy and happiness and a good family and their garden and a good life. About 10 to 15% of the population are just motivated by power. The large majority are motivated by what I call conscience, those that want to do the right thing and that get joy out of doing the right thing, and they're not out to take yours. But that 10 to 15% is amazing. They don't know joy. They only know kind of an envy. So if you have anything, they think they should take it. They think they must have it. they are driven, like you and I get a glass of orange juice in the morning, they're driven for power. They'll be the coercive controllers at home. They'll be coercive controllers over their family. They only interpret love as being compliance. They're motivated to be I think we just saw one elected in South Carolina. I couldn't believe the verbiage that this, Sanford or whatever that had the affair with the South American woman. And the way he talked, it was just incredible. It was just sociopathic. It's like, I can do anything, and I'm just going to lay it out here, and you're going to have to like me anyway. They are really interested in power jobs. They'll run for office. They'll sit with the flag behind them and their nice little family cheating on the side all day long because they're takers. They have to take, and they don't care if they lie or cheat or whatever. Some of them end up in prison. Not enough of them do. And those that get power over workers, they'll be the heads of the corporations. I do training for big companies, for their workers. And when I go in, what I see is that I've got conscience-centered people with good values, given a three-ring binder as what their limits are, what they can do and can't do. One place I train for is 100,000 at least square feet, all cubicles with people on the phone with these little binders. Now, if someone at the top tells you you can't allow the people to get a medication they need, your little rule book says you have to deny them what you know they need. This stresses those people terribly. When they come into my session, they're massively stressed, because their whole day, they're providing for their family, they're working on their retirement, they can't just quit the job, but the job is grinding them against their own values to the point that it's hurting them very badly, stressing them very badly. So what does our culture focus on? It focuses on a bottom line at all costs. You know, if you look at the power centered and those that tend to get in positions of power, now they're owning a lot of the media. And so we're all compromised to that. When it comes to medicine and the bottom line is the issue, what happens to people that need that, you know, have to take some? Sometimes people are disabled to the point that for a temporary period or longer, they need help. We're not rich enough to give them help. You know, we're not rich enough to be successful and share. But the banks have set quite a tone, you know, by hoarding the money and not loaning it, not taking care of people with mortgages. Seeing, you have to have shelter. And one of the problems with the homeowners associations is you come home from one of these tough days at work, and all of a sudden, oh, my God, if I park there, so-and-so's going to complain. Oh, my God, if my kids want to go roller skate, oh, my God, you know. They're afraid of being in trouble, afraid of being fined.
Well, I think some of them are afraid of going to their mailboxes because they're afraid of what they're going to find in their mailboxes.
Absolutely. And one of the signs of legal abuse syndrome is fear of getting the mail. Legal abuse syndrome is PTSD caused by a legally instituted system having power over you and stressing you and taking your rights away.
What happens to the kids who grow up in these things? The kids who are in the car with mom and dad when they come home, and mom and dad are afraid of checking the mail. Mom and dad are afraid of doing anything. They walk in and they're, oh my gosh, there's a dead flower there. I need to deadhead it before I get fined and potentially lose my house over it. How do these kids grow up?
Not trusting anybody, not trusting adults, not being excited about having a family and a home, scared to get married because they don't want to end up in a court. It's incredible what we're doing to our children. And the other part is putting them in debt for their education so they can't make choices. if I come out of law school and I owe $120,000 and I decide I really would have liked to been a doctor, how do I ever switch? You know, we're taking so many rights away from people. But yes, the children are, the children live in that adversarial, someone's looking at me, criticizing me environment. When I was a kid, the neighbors got after you, but they got after you directly. Don't do that. I'm going to tell your mother. You know, oh my God, now you're in court. Now your whole home is threatened. And these people come home, they can't rest, they can't recuperate, they can't enjoy their property.
So we're really destroying everything from the home up.
Yep.
All right. What's it going to take?
Well, I think, you know, over my lifespan, the most important thing, I think, is that each person stand firm. And that's what we try and help them do. If every person I go to court with, and people say, well, you're not making a big difference when you go to court with one at a time. Yeah, I am. I am. Because if one person stands firm, insists upon their federal rights, and we are able to affect that court so they get a fair hearing, then we have impacted somewhat what follows. And I think all we can do as human beings, I can only control me and the people around me. You know, that's all I have any impact on, and the people that read my books and that kind of thing. But by standing firm and understanding, you don't have to let somebody make you injured in that courtroom. Stop with the ball-peen hammer. You know, you're making me limp. I need time off. I need to rethink this. I need to gather my resources and come back in with federal law behind me. And no, you're not going to make fun of me. I had a client with a very bad cleft lip and palate that had a speech impediment because of it. And coming up the courthouse steps, opposing counsel would start mocking how he talked to undermine him before he got in the courtroom.
You're kidding.
No, I'm dead serious. Then they go in the courtroom and then they just keep poking at him. And I can't tolerate that. That makes me so angry, I have to stop and say, hold the phone. All of this is against federal law. All of it. You cannot ridicule. You cannot harass. You cannot intimidate. You cannot retaliate. That's against U.S. C. 42, Section 12203. And I use it in court a lot. Because they'll start coming after me. Oh, Your Honor, this looks like unlicensed practice of law when I'm there with the client.
Yeah, I've heard that one.
Yeah.
Got to stop you. All right, Karen, you're out in Colorado, right?
At the moment, I go between Nevada, Colorado, and Florida. And I go every place else in the country, too, but those are largely the places I stop.
All right. So somebody in Alaska, somebody in New York, somebody in Arizona, New Mexico, the heart of the country, anywhere in the Midwest, is having a problem. What do they do? Karen can't be everywhere to go into court with them. What do they do? How do we assert our rights? And how do we get the judge to get these monsters to back down?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that because I forgot one really important thing. I train advocates on webinars. So all over the country, someone that wants to learn what I do and what I've written about in my book and how to do it with the court can take my webinar. I have a new one starting in June. If they go on my website, they can sign up right there and they can get the dates. I usually do it about midday so that people can take my webinar on a lunch hour. They're about 2.5 hours long. And I train them as to how to apply for accommodations, how to help the client. Unfortunately, this is private pay, so the people pay themselves. we should have federal funding for it, but we don't. And I can't sit around and wait and beg legislatures to do the right thing for people. I have to go ahead and do what I can and then work on that on the side, and that's what we're doing. But it's very rewarding work, and it's something that I hope some people will want to do, because having that supportive person there with you, we sit right with that client. We watch if they're breathing. I can tell when they zone out. Sometimes they just can't bear to be there anymore mentally. And I call for a break. We take a break. I have 8 steps that we use to keep the person functional and to try and help prevent them from getting PTSD from the bad experience. But there's nothing like person-on-person help and kindness, and nothing worse than the opposite. So we try and oppose it by, I train them, I certify them, they have a badge they walk into court with, and then they are there with the client and help them get through. And it's interesting. It does make a difference.
So tell it, I mean, I've been to court with people a number of times. But I have no idea how to, I'm there to provide moral support, period. Because I'm not an attorney, I'm just there to let them know they're not alone. But tell us about the 8 steps that you just mentioned.
Okay, very important. The first step is called reframing, and we help the person get feeling better about themselves when they've been attacked. If you've just been called a horrible name, we call a break, and I say, we're going to have to reframe this. It's a 3-step process, and we say, they did it for this purpose. What wisdom have we gained from it? How are we going to internalize that ourselves? So that's one thing that we do, and they learn to do that quickly so that they can not be gotten down by intentional attacks. We do a debriefing process that divides the emotional and the medical from the legal side, because you cannot afford an attorney at the prices they charge to come in and sort through, well, this is something I can't do anything about, but this is the legal part I can do something about. We do all that sorting first. And then when we go to the attorney, we go with a plan so the person doesn't run out of money. 70% of my people, before I knew them, could not continue with their litigation because they ran out of money. So we have to say, this is how much money you have. This is the job that has to be done. And we have to find a legal way for you to do that and an attorney that will work with you realistically, not take a big retainer up front and then dump you pretty soon. We work on grieving, because when you have been forced to lose things like your home, or your peace, or any semblance of enjoying a neighborhood, that's a different kind of grief. It's an ongoing, relentless, miserable grief that does not transcend the way regular mourning does. So we work on that. The de-shaming part has to do with dealing with these power-centered people who are trying to take your civil rights away and take your stuff too. So how you deal with them, how you avoid them, how you deal with them once you're involved with them, how you get away from them, that kind of thing. We deal with empowering. Very important that people know how to respond to things. When they go in a courtroom, one of the first things that happens is your opposing side usually tries to take control of the court. Even if it's your motion and it's your turn, opposing side will attempt to say, oh, Your Honor, before we get started, can I just? No, 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 no. If our person is supposed to go first, then we protect their right to go first. And then they get to say what they want to say instead of get bashed before they even can open their mouth. And one of the things that we teach them to do is telegraph. Your Honor, they're going to attempt to take control of the court now and tell you this, which is misinformation. And that is so they'll diminish my ability to function. So I need you not to cooperate with that. I need to go first, and I need to tell you. And they're going to be saying this. They're going to be lying about me that way. That's just what they do. So So if you telegraph it before, then when they stand up to say it, you've taken some of the zip out of their message. We work on deflecting so that you're not gotten down by what other people say so much. It's very hard. But we use terms like nevertheless, regardless, you know, you can't trust her. She owes the government a lot of money. You know, they'll say that kind of thing. Say, regardless of the false assertions made by the other side, Your Honor. And then, because many of my people have to go in pro se. Many do not have attorneys. They've lost them. It's not by choice. It's by a terrible circumstance in our country that, you know, it's quite a luxury to have a lawyer. About 70% in Colorado are pro se. So only a small number in Colorado anymore are represented. But anyway, we work on that in recovery, and we have another service that we do called therapeutic mitigation, where if they're communicating with somebody that's very pathological for them, they can do it through email, through our advocates, and we take out all the inflammatory language, and we just keep the basic message going. And we improve communication. We don't go into court for a win. We go in for good communication. So everyone's heard, and it's fair. And so by the time you learn the 8 steps and you work with the people along those, then our goal is to get the people more and more on their own so they are less and less dependent. And they implement the 8 steps on their own as much as possible.
Karen, you do this for everybody who goes into court, right? Anybody who goes into court, regardless of what the case is about.
The case is of no interest to me. What matters to me is their functionality. Okay. Oh, I can say of no interest. I get really angry when there's something very unfair going on. However, if I keep my eye on that person's ability to function, and my eye on the law that puts them in a bubble where they have to have a fair hearing, then they get a fair hearing. If they lose and it's been fair, you know what? People can live with that. And if they win, that's great. But the issue here is they go up against a monster, a legal monster right now when they have any kind of impairment, even an injury caused by the court.
Okay, point that I was going to try to make was, what percentage of your clients are HOA members? Are the cases HOA related?
I don't do a lot that are simply HOA related. What happens is it comes in as a piece and parcel of other things, of probate, of divorce, of you know, any number of things, the HOA issues leak in. So the HOA often start before I get the client. Those are issues that go on in the neighborhoods where they're oppressed, and they need to look at, in their state, Title III of the Americans with Disabilities Act, because if they have a disability or they're being caused an injury, some states are very good about enforcing the federal law that you have to have equal access and equal treatment. And I think in some cases, people who are disabled are targeted, and because they're easy prey. And I think it's very important for them. If a homeowners association is targeting them, that would come under Title III, among other things.
Now, we have the fair housing laws that are there to protect you. We have the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the Americans with Disabilities Act, you tend to think of physical disabilities, in some rare cases, emotional disabilities where you need, for instance, a pet to help you with your emotional disabilities. But if I understand what you're telling me, you can come under the ADA just because you're being stressed out by the situation and by the treatment you're receiving from your neighbors. Am I correct?
If that treatment appears, well, let's say they won't let you have your service animal. if that treatment appears to be targeting you unfairly and you are not being given your civil rights, yes, that is exactly what I'm saying. And I worked on a case just like that. The neighbors claimed that the service dog was barking and bothering them. And in fact, normally service dogs don't bark much at all, you know. So, but we had to pull in the federal laws. We had to deal with them. It never went, it never went far with the court. Once we got going in the court, and this was in Southern California, then the neighbors withdrew their, the neighborhood withdrew their complaint and allowed her to have her service dog. And it was a service dog for emotional issues, kind of a comfort dog, sort of a chihuahua, small dog. So it wasn't one for the blind that very often they'll, but they accused her of lying about her, you know, that's not their business.
Oh, I've heard that so many times. You don't need a dog. You're just saying that. And that's so unfair, so nasty.
That's against the law, too. So it's not their business to know your medical. Not their business. That dog has a right to be there. And I write quite a few of those letters helping people to get their animal and explain. The dog has to serve a real physical purpose. And in one case, I have a client with a neurological disorder that can't tolerate being too close to other people. So this person has a dog that kind of circles around him and keeps people from getting too close. That's his job. It works wonderfully. He behaves well. Everybody likes the dog once they get around him a little bit. But you have, you again have that 10 to 15%. Who, if they can pick at something, tear it apart, those are people that do not build. They steal other people. If you build a stack of blocks, they will come to pull the blocks out to tear them down because that's the only power they have. So they're very destructive people.
There's something physically wrong with, or physiologically wrong with them, I would think, or mentally wrong with them, to even bother about wondering why other people, you know, to get involved with other people.
It's a coercive control thing. And what we find with people who enjoy coercive control is that it isn't something that you can do therapy for. It isn't an illness they can go get treatment for. It's a condition. They're born for some reason, and you can have a family of five people and have one kid born with this, and they want to control the household by any means necessary. And if we don't call it for coercive control, and what we have to do is inconvenience the coercive controller, we do the best to educate them and to inconvenience when they're doing what they're doing wrong. In other words, we don't comply. We explain to them we're not going to comply, and here's why. But if they're your boss or they get a position of tremendous power, you know, then they employ people, et cetera, like I said, and then they have coercive control. So we need to be identifying who do we not want to relate with? Who are we afraid of? It's people who use coercive control over another. Nothing else much matters in human interaction, in my opinion.
Yeah, size, nothing, huh?
Right. And these are the people that want to get on the boards of homeowners associations. First thing they do, they got to run for the board. They got to get on the board. Then they got to see what favors they can do for people in the community from their position on the board. I was involved in one case where the board was charging $425 every time they had a meeting. And I said, what are they eating or drinking that they have to charge the association to have a meeting?
Wow.
And so we looked into it, and then we altered that so that one person volunteered their house, made coffee and cookies, and charged nothing for the meeting, so saved the association that. Next thing we found, they were going to steal property. They were stealing big houses on big pieces of land and doing it through paper shuffles through the board. And some of the board members got away with some of it. It was caught after one-fifth of the common area was taken by one of them into private ownership and then resold. And we stopped the rest of them taking the common area and supported the people that were working to try and do it right. But they had friends doing the management, and they were billing the association every month. It was an equestrian estate, and so in one case, when they were to buy hay, the person said to the person that we sent from the neutral group to buy hay, said, "You want to buy it the usual way?" And they said, "Well, what is that?" "Well, usually it's $80 a town, but for your organization, we charge $140, and then they kick back the difference. We said, "No, no, we want the $80.
Oh, wow. Was this in Las Vegas?
Yep.
Is this part of the big investigation that's going on, or is this a separate issue?
It was prior, and a very prominent person got away with that property and never did get caught. It was a big house on about an acre ten of land, and he just slickied it out from the association. It was incredible. You know, so the awful things, and then in order for the board to keep control, instead of being like neighbors, they become adversaries to the homeowners. Policemen and adversaries. If I buy in a homeowners association, it's to keep the outside people from hurting me, not to police me in the association.
I know. It's so turned around and so obnoxious. It's just become really horrible. And the fact is that we're not learning our lessons. We're not deciding that, wait a minute, we can't do this. It's not working. We need to take a good, strong, hard look at what we're doing here. We just keep building them and building them and building them because they benefit local municipalities, they benefit the industry, and they benefit the developers.
Right. And they sound good from the outside. Well, you've always got security. You've always got, you know your property is going to be kept up. Forget it. There is nothing about somebody's garbage can being out overnight that is worse than a nasty homeowner that picks on you all the time.
That's true. That's absolutely true.
Damage your property like bad neighbors. And I've watched it in so many associations where they now create the problem. Yeah, in one case, they came by and said, "Can we use three homes?" The association did, to paint these new colors. And then we're going to put a little sign in your front yard. Then we're going to tell everybody to come by these houses and vote for which color they want for the next trim colors. So the people allowed them to paint. So then they came by and fined them for not having the paint that was the uniform color in the neighborhood.
And this is the association did that?
Yes.
Whoa.
And they had asked if they could do it, you know, to make the models for these colors. Yeah, so they contrived situations then to create. And then when we went to court on that one, the attorney wasn't going to talk about anything except he kept saying, "You're just too far apart. You're just too far apart to talk this over." And I said, "No, they're not too far apart. They're neighbors. And they don't want to waste money on legal fees. And they're not far apart. They have issues that need to be discussed. But don't try and create a war where one doesn't exist." But that attorney was determined to try and get a whole lawsuit started.
Well, that's the way they make the money, is they create these problems and then they litigate. And they get whacking great big fees. And the homeowners are left holding the bag, trying to pay it off.
And the homeowner gets to pay both sides.
Absolutely.
And their opposition, which is really unfair.
It absolutely is. Karen, would you believe we're out of time?
It went very fast, but it always does with you.
Thank you so much for coming on, and thank you so much for everything that you're doing. good luck with your books. Would you tell us the names of the books again and give us your website?
Well, short names are Legal Abuse Syndrome and Unlocking Justice. Website is equalaccessadvocates.com. And I hope that I'll get, I want so many people joining me to become advocates that around the country we are flooding the courts with the right thing. I'm training as hard and fast as I can.
I love it. Thank you so much, Karen. I hope you'll come back really soon.
I will, Sue, and thank you so much. Keep up the good work. Bye-bye.
Bye. Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.